Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the ousting of Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott by his own Liberal Party, that is in fact the Conservative Party, in an internal ballot that elected Malcolm Turnbull as its new leader. Frank Stilwell, a Professor Emeritus in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney, joins us to discuss the second challenge in 7 months to Abbott's leadership that has been widely lampooned at home and abroad for maladroit slips of the tongue and boneheaded decisions such as awarding the Queen's husband, Prince Philip, an Australian knighthood. We will also discuss the difference that Malcolm Turnbull brings to Australia's leadership, since unlike his predecessor, he believes in global warming, which has severely impacted Australia. Then we'll examine the circumstances surrounding the killing of 12 tourists, two of whom were from Mexico, by the Egyptian military using an Apache helicopter supplied by the US, who have resumed military ties with Egypt's ruling military junta after a boycott in response to the military coup that overthrew Egypt's first elected government. Bruce Rutherford, a professor of political science and director of the Middle Eastern Studies and Islamic Civilization program at Colgate University and author of Egypt After Mubarak, Liberalism, Islam and Democracy in the Arab World, joins us. Then finally, we'll discuss the deep denial at the top of America's leadership that has been unable to confront the reality that Pakistan takes our money and kills our troops in Afghanistan. Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan who was a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program, joins us to discuss her article at the National Interest, "When It Comes to Afghanistan, America Should Ditch Pakistan for Iran," and the possibility that the Iran deal affords the U.S. an opportunity to get right what we've gotten wrong in Afghanistan ever since 9/11. And joining us now from Sydney, Australia, is Frank Stilwell, who's a Professor Emeritus in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney. He is well-known a critic of conventional economics and an advocate for alternative economic strategies which promote social justice and economic sustainability. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Stilwell.
It's my pleasure, Ian.
And I take it there's a certain amount of rejoicing going on down under, as they say here in the United States.
Yeah, for the last 2 years, Australia has had a Prime Minister who, frankly, has been an embarrassing figure, an embarrassment to the nation, a source of conflict internally, and, frankly, not a very good public face around the world.
So he's
being replaced by someone who at least has a better style, although the substance remains to be seen.
But in terms of Australia's high turnover of prime ministers, which is, I think, pretty unusual, there have been a number of coups, party coups, in with the Labor Party that I think the Australian electorate finally got fed up with them and voted for the Liberal Party, which, of course, are the Conservatives, in protest, did they not?
Indeed, they did. Australia's had five prime ministers in 5 years. There were two changes during the last period when the Labor Party were in government. First of all, Kevin Rudd was the leader. He was ousted by an internal coup led by his deputy, Julia Gillard. Then when the next general election was looming, the party turned back to Rudd and gave him the leadership baton to take into the election, thinking that they would do better under his leadership. In fact, they lost that election. Tony Abbott was elected for the so-called Liberal Party, which is really the Conservative Party in Australia. And now he's been subject to an internal party coup of a very similar nature. So those who voted for the Liberal Party expecting stability now find that they've got a situation very similar to the previous Labor government, which fell into disrepute because of its internal conflicts.
Well, of course, that was the argument, apparently, that Tony Abbott made to his caucus. But they clearly didn't believe him because Turnbull won the support of 54 of the party's colleagues, his party's colleagues, compared to 44 who voted for Abbott. And of course, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop Will remain as deputy leader, and she won substantially. She secured 70 votes against 30 votes. So she must have been. Do you think that the Australian foreign minister was getting an earful around the world about how embarrassing her prime minister was? I mean, here in the United States, for example, there's a popular comedy show on HBO with a fellow called John Oliver. And a while back, he just put a compilation of clips of Tony Abbott's missteps and outrageous statements. And it was, quite frankly, it was pretty appalling.
Yeah, he's not a polished politician, to say the least. I mean, he was a bit of a bruiser and a battler in the way in which he got into politics. And you can see him trying to stay on message, keeping to three-word slogans, keeping it simple, repeating every phrase, in the hope of looking credible. But frankly, it all wore so thin. But it's hard to know whether Julie Bishop was picking up that message as foreign minister around the world, or whether she was just responding to the local dismay about this, frankly, hopeless leader. But no doubt she played a crucial role in the process. She was the deputy leader to Tony Abbott. She jumped ship, went public in supporting the challenger, Malcolm Turnbull, and she's now the deputy leader to Turnbull. So there'd be an element of continuity. She remains as foreign secretary for the time being, at least. And I think without her role in this process, it wouldn't have happened.
And again, I'm speaking to Frank Stilwell, who's in Sydney, Australia. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney. He's also a well-known critic of conventional economics and an advocate of alternative economic strategies which prioritize social justice and economic sustainability. So let's look at the new leader, the new Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull, a former investment banker and lawyer. He worked here in the United States for Goldman Sachs, and he was pretty much shunted aside by Abbott as the communications minister. But clearly, has he been sort of plotting this coup quietly behind the scenes? It's frankly not a surprise, because I'd heard rumors that this was going to happen for some time.
Malcolm Turnbull was always destined to be Prime Minister of Australia. I think he knew that from a fairly early age. In fact, I knew him when he was an undergraduate student at the University of Sydney. You could just see his own ego, his own ambitions. It led him onto a very successful career as a lawyer, subsequently as a merchant banker. Before he moved into politics in 2004. So he's wealthy, he and his wife together, who's also a successful lawyer and business person, over $100 million, making Turnbull probably the wealthiest or possibly second wealthiest person in the Australian political scene. So this is someone with drive, ambition, style. He's a good talker. Quite a presentable character, but he's not well liked by his own party. Yes, they have elected him by a fairly slim majority to be their new leader, because they were so desperate to oust Tony Abbott. But his somewhat small L liberal values don't sit comfortably with some of the more conservative elements within his own party. He recognises climate change, for example, as an important problem to be addressed, whereas his own party has got lots of climate sceptics or climate denialists who are most reluctant to embrace any policies that deal with climate change. Questions of gay marriage or marriage equality are also very contentious. Turnbull's on the small L liberal end of those debates, but there are conservatives within his party that don't want to budge. from any opposition to giving legal support to gay marriage. So big conflicts ahead. The real question is whether within 1 year before the next general election, he's got the sufficient basis to actually bring about a regeneration of his own party.
So, how, in trying to sort of relate to the U.S. audience here, Frank Stilwell, we of course have the Conservative Party here as the Republican Party, but it's become essentially captured by a far right wing of the Republican Party that's sort of been repackaged as the Tea Party, and in this election cycle. Because in the primary elections, the radicals in the parties, whether they're on the right of the Republican Party or on the left of the Democratic Party, hold greater sway. And then after the primary elections, then the candidates have to move back to the center for the general election. So we're in that period now where everybody's pandering to the Tea Party. And the Tea Party have some pretty potent candidates. They've got Donald Trump, who's way ahead, and Ted Cruz, etc. Will Turnbull have a Tea Party equivalent problem with his caucus?
There is a far right faction within the so-called Liberal Party in Australia, but it's nothing like as influential as in the US situation. So I don't think that's really his major challenge. It's a more conventional management process that he's got to deal with, managing the conflicting emphases of a traditionally conservative party, which also has a small L liberal wing with which he's been associated in the past.
So on the other side, the Labour Party, who lost power through their own fratricide, as we mentioned earlier, they were making something of a comeback in the polls, weren't they, until this happened?
Well, they've been consistently outpolling the incumbent government, and there's little doubt, I think, that in the general election that's due next year, they would stand at least a 50-50 chance of unseating the Liberal government. Which is kind of unusual in Australia because with a three-year electoral cycle, governments can normally expect to get two terms of office before they're voted out. And one-term Tony, as Prime Minister Tony Abbott has been parodied, was, I think, breaking the mould. I suspect the Labour Party are very disappointed today about the change in the leadership of the Liberal Party because Turnbull is going to be a tougher person to unseat than was Tony Abbott. He has more popularity, but frankly, that's not saying a whole lot since Tony Abbott was just appallingly unpopular even as leader, because he made promises in the election when he came to power, which he quickly broke. He looked completely erratic in his behaviour. He got no consistency, no programme, no long-term vision, no capacity to explain policies. His departure is no surprise, but the more fundamental challenges are ones of bringing about party unity, actually getting a coherent policy, particular economic policy, to deal with the growing economic difficulties that Australia faces.
Well, Australia, of course, is dependent. It's a resource-based economy. It's dependent upon China's economy to some extent, and China is slowing down. So they and Brazil are suffering as a result. The Prime Minister, I mean, the leader of the Labour opposition, he's not a particularly charismatic guy, though, is he? I mean,
no, he's not charismatic. In fact, I think a lot of his success in the polls has been, the opinion polls, that is because of Abbott's relative, even greater unpopularity. So there is, I think, a very different change in the personality appeals of those who will be offering themselves as Prime Minister in the election due next year. But the policy differences, I think, do remain substantial and significant. The In fact, it's very hard to identify what is the coherent policy of the incumbent Liberal government. Labor does have a clearer alternative on offer, which is to do with tax reform, it's to do with job creation, it's to do with a first-class national broadband network, a modernising program for the Australian economy.
Sure.
And I think that will still have appeal, notwithstanding Bill Shorten's, dubious leadership credentials.
And, of course, the national broadband program, which Labor were pushing, of course, was sabotaged by Rupert Murdoch, who has, of course, a lot of influence over the Liberal Party. So I take it that Turnbull will go along with Murdoch on blocking a national broadband.
Oh, yes. I mean, he has been the communications minister with responsibility for the broadband policy here, and I wouldn't anticipate any change in that at all, and indeed I wouldn't anticipate any diminution in Rupert Murdoch's influence over Australian politics.
Well, that's a sad thing to hear, but his malignant influence over American politics is quite enough. I can't escape it. Just in the last minute, Frank Stillwell, Abbott promised a lot when he was elected, and part of his election platform was 6 months paid pregnancy leave for all Australian women or their significant others, which is something that would never fly over here. The Democrats wouldn't even come up with something like that. And that, I think, is a lot to do with the fact that you have compulsory voting in Australia, which means that people vote for their interests and that even right-wing parties have to respect social democracy.
Yes, I think Abbott's advocacy of that generous program was largely politically motivated to counter the view that he's anti-women. So he clearly had to have something on offer that made him look more inclined towards policies that serve women's interests. But he junked the policy under pressure from within his own party. But in general, I think you're right that Australian politics has a social democratic character that's not evident in the United States. Pretenders to leadership have to have broad programs of economic and social reform. After all, we've got here a healthcare system that is largely publicly based, the envy of most small-L liberals in the United States, I suspect. And you can't get away with policies that are only catering to the wealthy. There's got to be an emphasis on social reform, on ecological sustainability, on creating a decent society, because that's what Australians expect.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Frank Stillwell.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Frank Stillwell, who's a Professor Emeritus in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney. He's a well-known critic of conventional economics and an advocate of alternative economic strategies which prioritise social justice and economic sustainability. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the killing of 12 tourists, two of whom were Mexico, by the Egyptian military using an Apache helicopter supplied by the United States.
الحكايا مواويل طرب وانا
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bruce Rutherford, who is a professor of political science and director of the Middle East Studies and Islamic Civilization Program at Colgate University. He's the author of Egypt After Mubarak, Liberalism, Islam, and Democracy in the Arab World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Rutherford.
Thank you for having me.
And Mexico is mourning the death of two of its citizens who were killed along with 12 people shot by the Egyptian counterterrorism forces in the Wahat region of the western desert of Egypt. And of course, among the 12 dead were Egyptians. But there seems to be a basic conflict here in terms of information. The Egyptian tourist ministry is saying that tourists are banned from this area. But the BBC is claiming from interviews with local people, including the hotels and the tour guides, operators, saying that they had permits. They, in fact, had a police escort. So what's going on here in terms of just basic information? Is this a case of people sort of covering their rear ends?
That's certainly possible, but there might actually be a case of simply with the relevant parts of the Egyptian government not talking to one another. In other words, it's entirely possible that the tour group got the necessary permit from the relevant tourist police and possibly even the relevant office of the Ministry of Interior. But it appears that this attack was carried out by the Egyptian military, and there might simply have been a lack of coordination between those two parts of the Egyptian government.
And we know that there's a very, very intense insurgency going on in the Sinai, and a number of Egyptian soldiers have been killed, and the Islamic State is infiltrating, and they've claimed some success. But this is the first incident on the western border near Libya, and my understanding is that the Egyptian forces deployed there are basically on an anti-smuggling operation to stop arms flowing across the border. So what's your understanding about who these soldiers were that shot up this tourist convoy?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that there have been attacks by Islamic militants in the Western Desert before. There was an assault back in July that killed a number of Egyptian soldiers. The big question mark, of course, is the degree to which those sorts of attacks are coordinated with ISIS or to the extent to which they're coordinated with the radical groups in Sinai. And that's just not very well known at this point. But there had been attacks on Egyptian forces in broad terms in the Western Desert. But keep in mind, the Western Desert is a very big area that borders Egypt and Libya. These attacks happened in Bahariya, which is southwest of Cairo, and actually not that far from Cairo. It's just a couple of hours' drive. So it's not as far out in the desert as where these previous attacks occurred. But my guess is that these earlier attacks that happened over a month ago now probably led the Egyptian military to really go on a heightened sense of alert and might have contributed to the Egyptian military being predisposed to assume that these people who were traveling were somehow threatening, even though they'd done nothing to suggest they were threatening.
So what is the appeal? Apparently this area is a popular tourist site. So that's, again, a part of the confusion over this, that the travel agency and the hotel are being blamed by the tourist ministry, but apparently this is a popular tourism site. And what would they be looking for, the tourists?
This is a very beautiful area. It has the natural topography. It's really very distinctive. You have these wonderfully, essentially, rock formations that have been carved by wind erosion over the centuries that are quite unique and quite beautiful. So it is a, I wouldn't say a common place for tourists to go, but it is a place that more adventurous tourists will visit. So it's not uncommon for tourists to be in this area.
And apparently they were on top of a sand dune and they were preparing to sort of camp for the night when they were attacked?
Well, according to the media reports that I've seen, that apparently this attack occurred around midday. So they had, according to the New York Times' coverage, they had stopped to have lunch and were attacked at that time.
And do we understand how this happened, whether they just came rolling up and shot them? I mean, you would think that a bunch of tourists preparing to have lunch wouldn't look like insurgents.
Well, according to the Times' coverage, apparently the attack was carried out by a helicopter. So it's possible the helicopter just attacked without taking the time to take a close look at who they were shooting at.
I see. So what's your understanding then of the general... Would this be an indication of a certain level of paranoia in the Egyptian military?
I think it's an indication of just how concerned the Egyptian military is about two things. One is the possibility that the radical Islamists who are based in Sinai would be able to effectively open up a second front on the, in the Western Desert. And the second is the possibility that weapons and fighters from Libya, and particularly weapons left over from the Gaddafi regime, could be smuggled across the border and could provide both fighters and weaponry that could make that second front more feasible. So my guess is that they're immensely worried about that occurring and that this decision to really scale up their military preparedness in the Western Desert and to shoot with very little provocation is driven by that really urgent need on the Egyptian military side to make sure that no sort of insurgency takes root in the Western Desert.
And again, I'm speaking with Bruce Rutherford, who's a professor of political science and director of the Middle Eastern Studies and Islamic Civilization Program at Colgate University. He's the author of Egypt After Mubarak, Liberalism, Islam, and Democracy in the Arab World. So assuming then that this helicopter had kind of fairly flexible orders to shoot on site what they thought was any kind of infiltration from Libya of insurgents or arms traffickers, would this mean then that if they're flying around shooting up people for some time that we don't know about?
That's entirely possible. The Egyptian government has put tight constraints on the movements of independent journalists in Egypt, so we really don't have a clear independent account of what's going on outside of the major cities.
And what is happening in Sinai? We'd certainly, I mean, for the longest time, there's been a UN presence there, a multinational force. I guess they must not be deployed anywhere near where the fighting's going on.
There have been some occasions where soldiers in that international force have been attacked and were killed by accident, but that's been quite rare. I should mention those forces are there as part of the Camp David peace accords. They've been there ever since 1979, so they're not there as part of the fight against the Islamic insurgency, but they're, and at least in the past, they've been deployed in places that made them vulnerable to attack.
And in terms of press coverage, if the Egyptian government's not anxious to have journalists wandering around in the Western Desert, I imagine, well, I'm not even sure the journalists would be crazy enough to go into Sinai. My understanding is that Sinai has been a no man's land for the longest time. It's been run by criminal gangs, smugglers, human traffickers, etc. But now it's sort of metastasized into a kind of insurgency with the Islamic State infiltrating.
That appears to be the case. I mean, the government, I mean, going back many, many years, the government in Cairo has always had difficulty exerting full control over Sinai. I mean, this challenge goes back centuries even. They have, I mean, it's fair to say their control of the coasts is probably reasonably good, and they have control over Sharm el-Sheikh at the very tip of Sinai. But the interior has always been difficult to control, in part because of the topography. Much of it is very mountainous, and so it's very easy for smugglers or others to be able to hide out and essentially act with no effective enforcement of law from Cairo.
And what are the relationships then with the U.S. military and the Egyptian military in this regard, given that the U.S. is working with its Arab allies, among them, I believe, Egypt, in its bombing campaign against the Islamic State in both Syria and Iraq? Does this extend to some kind of military cooperation between the U.S. and Egypt over the Sinai?
It does, yes. The U.S. at one point has suspended its military assistance to Egypt out of concern over the removal of Mohamed Morsi from office by the Egyptian military. The U.S. resumed that military aid largely out of concern over the development of Islamic radical groups in Sinai and, to a lesser extent, the Western Desert. And that military aid included giving the Egyptians more Apache helicopters, and it was an Apache helicopter that was involved in this attack in the Western Desert. There's no way of knowing if it's the specific helicopter that we gave as part of this package, but this is the type of capability that the United States has been providing to the Egyptians, the ability to have these very powerful, very mobile military helicopters that can work both in Sinai and in the Western Desert.
And I take it that there must be some also cooperation and coordination between the Egyptian military and the Israelis, because the Israelis are quite happy to have the Sisi and the military back in charge, as indeed the Saudis, who largely financed the coup against the Muslim Brotherhood.
I think it's certainly true. There is, and it's sort of this interesting moment of an alignment of interests between Egypt, Israel, and the Saudis, and also others, the UAE, in confronting the rise of ISIS and more broadly the rise of radical Sunni Islamic groups. And it's, I think, safe to assume there's been meaningful coordination between the Egyptians and the Israelis over this matter. It's hard to know the degree of coordination between the Israelis and the Saudis or the Israelis and the UAE, since their diplomatic relations are technically non-existent. But Israel is, of course, at peace with Egypt, so there's been longstanding security communication and, I think, fair to say, coordination.
Well, I understand that the Egyptian authorities are cooperating with the Israelis to block aid to Hamas in the Gaza because of that border with Egypt in the Gaza. And, of course, Hamas is a protege, if you will, of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And they had these smuggling tunnels operating. And now the Egyptian military went in and blew up the tunnels. And then they leveled buildings, I think, and created a kind of no-man's-land corridor, did they not? Along that border.
They did. They, particularly in Rafah, which was the Egyptian town that was closest to the border with Gaza, they came in and just, as you said, leveled a number of civilian buildings simply to, I mean, the rationale here was that the tunnel starting point were in the basement of these buildings, and so they leveled the buildings, and this was private property belonging to Egyptian civilians, but the Egyptian military believed the step was necessary to secure the border.
So what do you think the effect is going to be? Obviously, the Mexican government are protesting, but the fact that this was a U.S.-supplied Apache helicopter, I guess, is going to create some kind of backlash. But it seems to me that at this point, the U.S. has sort of had to sort of backtrack a little bit in terms of its condemnation of Egypt in the name of realpolitik. And if that's the case, that Egypt's government, particularly this military government, we have to support it in the national interest. What exactly is the national interest that you could describe to our audience in terms of supporting this government that, you know, we all celebrated? Many of our audience, of course, was very excited about Tahrir Square, and it's all turned rather sad and sorry since then. So what is the realpolitik argument for supporting the Egyptian military?
Well, I think it has two components to it. The first is the observation that one of the repercussions of the Arab Spring is that it created a great deal of instability in the region, and particularly on Egypt's western border. Libya has effectively disintegrated, but also instability in Syria, instability in Iraq and elsewhere. The second observation is that radical Islamic groups have been able to exploit that instability, particularly in Syria and Iraq with the rise of ISIS, but there are other radical Islamic groups as well. And the heart of the argument is that at this particular moment, the combination of instability and well-organized, well-funded Islamic radical groups poses a threat to regional stability and to American interests more broadly, simply because instability in the Middle East can challenge American allies and also even spread to American shores. Therefore, we need to support the few stable and effective regimes in the region, and Egypt under al-Sisi is one of those stable and effective regimes. I mean, the counterargument, of course, is that the tactics that al-Sisi is using stimulate precisely the radicalism that we're trying to fight, and that al-Sisi is, in fact, part of the problem, not part of the solution. And this debate is ongoing in Washington, but at this point, the argument about strategic need to support relatively stable regimes is the one that's prevailing.
But at the end of the day, one would think, though, that Sisi's cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood in the way that he has and issuing these vast numbers of death sentences to both the leadership and to rank and file. I don't remember the percentage of the vote that they got in the election, but I think let's assume it's, you know, 40% or 40%+. If you have 40% of your population that had a brush with democracy and voted for a party that's now outlawed, that's a lot of potential insurgents, isn't it?
It is. I mean, one of the more striking ways to think about this is that the Brotherhood had a degree of support in those elections, which suggested two things. One is that it has a core of support, but more generally, there was broader public sympathy for what the Brotherhood was advocated in terms of changing the regime. But the question, of course, is whether that broader public support, in fact, constituted any sort of endorsement of the Brotherhood's ideology. And secondly, whether the Brotherhood had shown its capacity to govern effectively. And the al-Sisi and his supporters assert that the Brotherhood's electoral success did not constitute an endorsement of its ideology. It simply reflected dissatisfaction with the old order, and that the Brotherhood had shown itself to be incompetent at being actually able to manage the state, and that the result had been economic chaos and growing political chaos, and the military needed to intervene to introduce a measure of stability. But your point is well taken. If only, say, 10% of the Brotherhood's core supporters decide to become radical and use violence, that produces a pool of tens of thousands of people that can sustain a low-intensity insurgency for a great deal of time.
And it's worth pointing out, surely, that the Egyptian military didn't just move against the Muslim Brotherhood. They also moved against the liberal opposition who brought about the Tahrir Square demonstrations in the first place.
They did. Several of the people who organized those demonstrations are now in jail in Egypt.
Well, I thank you for filling us in on this story, which I guess is probably going to be with us for a little while.
It will. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
I thank you for joining us, Bruce Rutherford.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Rutherford, who's a professor of political science and director of the Middle Eastern Studies and Islamic Civilization Program at Colgate University. He's the author of Egypt Under Mubarak, Liberalism, Islam, and Democracy in the Arab World. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the deep denial at the top of America's leadership that has been unable to confront the reality that Pakistan takes our money and kills our troops in Afghanistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and is professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program, who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Women in International Security, and the American Institute for Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. And her latest article at the National Interest is When It Comes to Afghanistan, America Should Ditch Pakistan for Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing. Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And there seems to be slowly in the sort of political zeitgeist a recognition amongst our punditry and our specialists on international relations that the American relationship with Saudi Arabia has not been a particularly healthy one, and there's been an extraordinary amount of duplicity, and now there's a possibility of Saudi involvement even in 9/11, not to mention the extent to which they have inspired, if not financed, the Islamic State, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Al-Shabaab, and so on. But it seems in many ways also that the other dysfunctional relationship that we have that's just as perfidious with Pakistan is there seems to be a kind of an impenetrable wall of denial. At least we're starting to wake up that there's something wrong with our relationship with Saudi Arabia. But do you get the feeling that we're waking up, that something is wrong with our relationship with Pakistan?
Oh, boy. I wish I could say that, but this is what I can tell you. At the functional level of our bureaucracies, and what do I mean by that? The people that are doing the intelligence, the people that are engaging the country, our military, particularly those that have served in Afghanistan, folks at the various intelligence agencies, cannot stand Pakistan. They make the point that you make, the point that I make repeatedly, that the money keeps flowing from the American taxpayer to Pakistan's hands, which they then use to kill our troops in Afghanistan. However, the problem is that the apex leadership, there is this perpetual desire to see in Pakistan something which is not there, which is a Pakistan that can be redeemed, a Pakistan that can be bought, a Pakistan that can be coerced to do America's bidding. And that optimism, I would also just call it cupidity, also stupidity, is buttressed by the very few occasions when, for example, in the months immediately after 9/11, when Pakistan did indeed do a U-turn and did indeed support the U.S. operations in Afghanistan. But what tends to not get the attention that it deserves is what it did after that, which is it did a U-turn on its U-turn for a variety of reasons that we can discuss. And basically began directly killing our troops through its proxies, the Afghan Taliban. So the question is, why does the apex American leadership do this? It's really quite genius and simple. The Pakistanis terrorize the Americans with their use of terrorists as means of foreign policy under the explicit umbrella of its nuclear weapons. So what this means is that they know the Americans are worried that terrorists will get nuclear weapons. It uses this fear to generate a revenue stream in perpetuity, which it then uses to create more terrorists and more nuclear weapons. So it is a self-licking ice cream cone. And the Americans can say, well, we have influence in Pakistan. I'm going to submit to you it does not. And not only that, not only do we incentivize the two things that we fear most from Pakistan, the American taxpayer is actually writing the bill for it.
So what you're saying, though, in this article at the National Interest, when it comes to Afghanistan, America should ditch Pakistan for Iran, Chris Fair, is that finally there's a way out. And you're arguing that the agreement with Iran affords us an historic opportunity to get right what we've gotten wrong in Afghanistan ever since September 11th. So elaborate on that.
Yeah, so basically here was our dilemma. The Bush administration didn't really understand reality, as we know, at so many levels. And it really didn't understand Pakistan's thinking. It didn't understand how Pakistan viewed Afghanistan. And one of the first things that we did that I would argue really conditioned the way Pakistanis thought about the Americans is that we let the Northern Alliance take Kabul. Musharraf was adamant that the Northern Alliance not take Kabul. And the reason for that is that the Indians, along with the Iranians, the Russians, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, and everyone else, had been propping up the Northern Alliance. But when the Pakistanis looked at that panoply of support, they really only saw the Indians. And so from Musharraf's point of view, we basically handed the Indians the keys to Kabul. And so, again, from Musharraf's point of view, and I would argue from any Pakistani general's point of view, immediately Pakistan became less secure than it was on, say, September 9th, 2001, and began this U-turn. The problem is that because we did not have relations with Iran, which I've argued, I believe, in that piece, but certainly elsewhere, the Iranians were very supportive of that war. And particularly under Khatami's leadership, he worked to ensure that the Iranian participants in the Bonn delegation put democracy in Afghanistan's constitution, that the constitution ratified the value of the war on terrorism, and of course what Khatami was rewarded with was being included in the Acts of Evil speech. Now hang on to that thought, because what we needed to sustain that war and our presence in Afghanistan was ground lines of control that would allow us to move war material from a port onto rail or road shipments to get stuff into Afghanistan. We ended up going with Pakistan, the only country, apart from Saudi Arabia and perhaps the Emirates, that opposed what we were trying to do in Afghanistan. And as our troop presence increased in Afghanistan, in part because we were being defeated by the Taliban because of the support they enjoyed by Pakistan, we became more dependent upon Pakistan. When what we needed to do was decrease our dependence upon Pakistan, give it a pretty serious kick in a place where it needed to be kicked, and basically coerce it to stop supporting the Taliban as it had. To do that, however, we needed an alternative. The northern distribution route was never a viable alternative because the Russians, because of its antagonism towards NATO, Russia did not want us to use the northern distribution route for lethal goods, which obviously you need to fight a war. Because we were completely unable to see Iran in any other light except through the light, which is a country that supports terrorism and engages in nuclear proliferation, irony, we were never able to see that Iran had exactly what we needed, which was a port, and even closer and at that time more secure access to Afghanistan. If you look at a map, the Chabahar port, which is being built with help from the Indians, was linked to the Ring Road, again, with help from the Indians. That would have been a shorter route to put our stuff into Afghanistan, and it would have rendered us less dependent upon Pakistan, the country which is largely responsible for the defeat that we're experiencing in Afghanistan.
And again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program who specializes in South Asian security issues. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Women in International Security, and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. And her latest article at the National Interest is When It Comes to Afghanistan, America Should Ditch Pakistan for Iran. So what indications are there? I know there's been a lot of bad blood since Khatami reached out and shortly after the invasion of Iraq basically went to the Bush-Cheney White House hat in hand and basically said, everything's on the table, we want a deal. And Dick Cheney, who was effectively running the country, basically said, we don't talk to evil.
I know.
I mean, it's
so ironic because Pakistan is evil.
Right.
It's by that criteria, if Iran is evil, Pakistan does more than Iran could ever dream of doing, and yet we have, you know, that administration found a way of making Pakistan the center of our war effort in Afghanistan, even though it has proliferated more than Iran has by orders of magnitude, and it supports more terrorism than Iran could ever dream of doing, and it's done so for longer since 1947. It's really mind-boggling, isn't it?
So what, with this deal, what gives you the sense that maybe this deal is an opening to, because my understanding is that the Indians and the Iranians certainly don't want the Taliban to come back. There's some indication that maybe even the Pakistanis don't want, because there's a possibility of reverse sanctuary for Pakistan's Taliban. But so walk us through that possibility of what could happen in terms of geopolitical realignments to make this happen so that we wouldn't be so dependent upon not just the Pakistanis, but also the route through Pakistan that they've gouged us on for so long.
Okay, so basically what this does do is it gives us a chance to rethink what we're doing right now. And what we're doing right now is basically replicating what we did in 1990, which is we've been chastened, we went out of Afghanistan, we're tired, we're war-weary, and whereas we were the victors in the 1980s, now we're actually retreating with our tail between our legs, and we are hoping that the Pakistanis can give us some honorable exit. As we did in 1990, we are willing to hand over our Afghan policy to the Pakistanis. And what this means explicitly is that the Pakistanis, we are hoping, will deliver some negotiated settlement with the Afghans and the Taliban. In other words, deliver to the Taliban what they could not otherwise achieve, because they would never contest elections, and certainly if they did, very few of them would actually prevail at the level to which they might expect some sort of political accommodation. Now, we can talk about the degree to which the announced demise of Mullah Omar complicates this, but we were and are hoping that the Pakistanis can deliver us a way out. And essentially, that will mean delivering a victory to the Taliban, because we just don't have the patience to keep staying in Afghanistan under these conditions. Now, right now, we are not so dependent upon Pakistan's GLOCs. We learned to move a lot of things through air at a very expensive price. But if we're going to stay in Afghanistan and basically stay the course to prevent the Taliban from returning to power, we're going to actually need to have a long-term sustainable presence there. And being able to have even commercial relations with Iran, for example, right now in the Pakistan situation, the Pakistani government does not transport our goods. It's all done through the private sector, mostly this Pashtun trucking mafia. So this would similarly happen in Iran, right? We would be relying upon private sector entities to move goods from the port and into Afghanistan. And the other advantage is the distance is much shorter. So what this deal could allow us to do is to really rethink what our options are. India and Iran do not want the Taliban to come back. This is something, and by the way, Iran, this is always their position. They began providing tactical support to the Taliban when it became clear that the Bush administration was committed to keeping Iran as an enemy. But they did not have strategic support to the Taliban. So when you hear American soldiers, you know, talking about their experience with the Iranians in Afghanistan, they're not wrong, but they're also not understanding the big picture. So the other thing that this allows us to do, if we are going to be more coercive towards Pakistan, declaring it, for example, to be a state sponsor of terror, we really need to make sure that we have all of Pakistan's neighbors near and far behind us. And Iran, you know, has absolutely no love lost for the Pakistanis, at least in part because of the ongoing war on Shia within Pakistan's borders. So I'm not suggesting that this is a magical bullet, but if we can give ourselves some space in Afghanistan to keep staying the course, and by staying the course, I do not mean continue to have a large military presence, but what I do mean is have a training presence that is sustainable, an economic presence that is sustainable. If we can stay this course, I think this relationship, this potential opening with Iran, means that we do not have to simply roll over and accept Pakistan's dictation on what Afghanistan's future looks like.
But Chris Fair, when you say that Iran and India are dead against the Pakistan taking over Afghanistan and bringing back the Taliban, the Afghanistan is against it too. I mean, there's not much love for the Taliban inside of Afghanistan, is there?
No, and there certainly isn't much love for the Pakistanis. I mean, Afghans, even those that are sympathetic towards the Taliban, for reasons that have less to do with the Taliban's ideology than for the fact that the Taliban do provide some basic things that Afghans need, like swift conflict resolution, which is not possible in Afghanistan's courts. And when you're largely an agrarian society, things like land disputes, family disputes, like, for example, over children running off, engaging in inappropriate behavior, these things can get pretty bloody pretty fast. And so the Taliban's ability to come in and resolve these things is something that people value. They also valued the period of security. Remember, this is because the Taliban came in after years of internecine warfare amongst different warlords. So the Afghans have a certain memory of the Taliban bringing stability, bringing security. It came at a high price, but right now they've got the worst of all worlds. They have violence. They have no security. It's not clear when any of this is going to end. So even the folks that have some sympathy towards the Afghan Taliban, they absolutely despise Pakistan because they understand that in some ways the Afghan Taliban, they're just a puppet. The actual puppet master is Pakistan itself.
So could there be a situation where the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, cut ties with Pakistan? If Pakistan is as unpopular as I understand it is, even with the Taliban, I mean, they're sheltered,
yes,
they're supplied, they're trained, yep, but at the same time, they are Afghan patriots, for the want of a better description.
Well, that's exactly it. And the reason why there's so much frustration with Pakistan is that the Taliban understand that what the Pakistanis want is basically a client state, right? They basically, you know, it's very imperial in terms of what it wants to achieve in Afghanistan, and naturally the Taliban oppose that. This is also driving this phenomenon of ISIS developing in Afghanistan, because what ISIS is allowing some of these less than thrilled Taliban commanders and sub-commanders to do is break away from the Taliban, not necessarily because they have an ideological affinity for ISIS, but it does give them an alternative organizational mechanism to basically show their opposition to the Taliban for so long, basically being the bootlicker of the Pakistan army. So this is, you know, also a very troublesome dynamic in Afghanistan, that you have the fractionalizing of the Taliban. And, you know, in the replacement of Mullah Omar, Mullah Mansour just doesn't have the same charisma or the same unifying skills that Mullah Omar has.
Well, just in closing, Chris Fair, one of the problems, apart from the fact that you point out that APEC leadership here in the United States would prefer the delusion than to deal with the reality of Pakistan, the same is true, from what I can tell, in Iraq. You know, you've got these people like Brett McKirk and others who basically just want to maintain the fiction that Iraq is still a country, and clearly they don't want to be on the watch when the place falls apart. So they just sort of have this kind of phony war with the Islamic State. Is that what we can expect from the Obama administration vis-a-vis Afghanistan? They just want to get the hell out of there, and they don't want things to be too unpleasant?
I mean, I'm not an Iraq expert, so I'm hesitant to talk about that. I think the problem with the Obama administration relative to Bush in this particular conflict of Afghanistan and Pakistan is that, unlike Bush, it didn't understand what it was doing, didn't understand the impacts of Pakistan, it didn't understand the nefarious consequences of its engagement, of U.S. engagement with Pakistan on these terms. The Obama administration came in pretty clear-eyed about what the problem was. They knew the problem was Pakistan from the get-go. And so the Obama administration does not have the defense of really being ignorant, because it's not ignorant. It benefited from several reviews that the Bush administration had not done until the last hours of the administration. So where I fault the Obama administration is that it has a pretty good understanding of what the situation is. It has simply failed to adopt a more appropriate policy. It has chosen to be blackmailed by Pakistan, in essence. And unless you can have a policy where you basically say, I'm not going to be blackmailed by Pakistan's use of terrorists and nuclear weapons, you're not going to be in a position to adopt a different relationship to all of the countries in South Asia. This has also hampered, for example, our relationship with India. India doesn't want to get too close to us. India says, look, you know, you're selling the Pakistanis a Perry-class frigate, and the Indians are rightly going to say, what is that for? Now, we can say, well, you know, it's actually for counter-piracy and counter-narcotics operations, but the Indians aren't going to buy it. So until we can get out of this coercion that Pakistan is exerting over us, our entire policy towards the region is going to be hamstrung. And so this obviously pertains to Afghanistan as well. I don't think the geopolitics of South Asia readily translate to the geopolitics of what we're facing in Iraq.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
All right, thank you so much, Ian. It's always so nice to be on your show. You always ask a good question.
Oh, thank you. And right. I enjoyed the conversation. And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who is a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program, who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Women in International Security, and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. And her latest article at the National Interest is When It Comes to Afghanistan, America Should Ditch Pakistan for Iran. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.